You are listening to the Hirschsprung's Hour on UK Health Radio, where I interview incredible people with a connection to Hirschsprung's disease and other associated conditions, such as IBD, IBS, Crohn's, colitis, and ulcerative colitis. Each week, I bring you a new and exciting interview with people from all walks of life, including charity founders, models, and professional sports people. We go through the ups and downs of having Hirschsprung's with a positive message throughout.
Hello and welcome to episode 129 of Tom's Hirschsprung's podcast. I am delighted this morning to be joined by Jody. Jody, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for coming on. Now, we're here to chat about your son who has Hirschsprung's. I guess, would you like to take us, well, start from wherever you like?
I can start from the beginning. When Ollie was born, he was 9 days late, but that wasn't causing any of the problems. When he got let out of hospital that night, but he hadn't pooed, hadn't passed the mucus plug or wasn't really drinking any of his milk, but the nurses and midwives didn't think there was any problem with that. So he got home that day and the midwives came out on the second day at home and did a visit and explained to her that he wasn't drinking his milk. He still hadn't pooed on day two. We thought maybe it was the milk in the bottles that might have been the problem. So we changed milk several times, changed bottles maybe 3 or 4 different times, thinking that would help, and it never. So then she left and says we'd keep an eye on it again. And instead of leaving it until the week to come back to visit, she came out on day 5. By day 5, he was sleeping literally like 12 hours. You had to wake him and try and get him to feed. Still wouldn't feed. He was being sick, but it was like electric green. And it was everywhere. But I was like, I don't understand how he can be being sick when there's nothing going in. So once we'd spoke to the midwife, she said, you need to go back to the hospital just to get him checked. It might not be anything serious, which obviously escalated. So we went to the Glasgow Royal Infirmary to the maternity ward where they took him into a room, did all sorts of blood tests. I know when babies are born, they can lose maybe 5 or 10% of their average birth weight when they're born, give or take, that they're allowed to do that. Ollie had lost maybe about 30% of that. So he had gone down, his face had all drawn in. But obviously he wasn't drinking any milk, he wasn't getting anything in his system and everything was coming out through sick. So we then got transferred to, it would have been the Glasgow York Hill, that's not there now. And he got put right into NICU and blood tests, contrast tests, everything. All the symptoms and some of the tests that were coming back. Hirschsprung's disease and cystic fibrosis are kind of quite close together. So it was either going to be one or the other. So they then did the contrast test that came back as negative for cystic fibrosis. And on day 8 of Ollie's life, he was diagnosed with Hirschsprung's disease on day 8.
Wow. I mean, that's quite a late diagnosis, really. I mean, it was
really, really, really intense.
Yeah, I imagine so. I mean, that's because usually it's, I mean, mind you, I say a late diagnosis, I was about 3 weeks, but the usual sort of around maybe 48 hours. Roughly.
Yeah. And I think he maybe would have got it sooner if maybe the midwives had took me more serious when he was in the hospital when he'd been born. That he hadn't took any milk. He'd maybe took, I don't know, 2 mils of milk or something in the whole time. He was born at 7 o'clock in the morning and we got let out about 10:30 that night and he'd maybe only taken about 2 mils of milk. And to them, they said that was fine. Obviously, it's not. And he hadn't passed the meconium plug or anything either. And they were quite happy to send him home. So I think if they'd maybe took that a little bit more serious, then he maybe would have got diagnosed within that 48-hour time frame.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's one of the classic signs, isn't it, of Hirschsprung's, the bile, lack of passing of meconium. But again, it's
So swollen, like he looked like he had like a pregnancy bump, so to say, the weight his abdomen, and because they'd lost so much weight, you could see his ribs round where his abdomen was obviously distended.
So all the classic signs, really.
Had literally every symptom probably in the book.
Yeah. Well, it
Had
definitely sounds like it. I mean, it sounds like all of the classic symptoms, but it's one of those things again, isn't it? The awareness, and
Yeah.
sometimes, and it shouldn't be this way, but sometimes it depends on what hospital you're at. You know, there will be
Yes.
some hospitals that will spot Hirschsprung's disease straight away and say, well, I know exactly what that is. And then they'll
Yeah.
test for it and all of that stuff. And there will be some that will sort of have, maybe in this case, sort of go, well, we'll see how it goes. But Hirschsprung's doesn't really, it doesn't get better on its own. You know, there's, you kind of need to do something with it.
Progressively worse. And I think as well, I know as his parents had never ever heard of Hirschsprung's disease. We'd never heard of it. We had heard of cystic fibrosis, so we were kind of like, right, okay, if it's that, we kind of know what to do and what can happen and stuff. But with Hirschsprung's, as soon as they said that, we were like, not got a clue what that entails, what's going to happen, what the journey is going to be like. And what a journey it's turned out to be. That's for sure.
No, we will
Definitely.
definitely get into that. But it's interesting you mentioned it was two things. One, the cystic fibrosis. I've heard that one before, where people said, well, it's either one or the other,
Yeah.
or can, or well, sometimes it can be neither, but usually you're not going to get both together. So I have heard that quite a few times from people who've been diagnosed with Hirschsprung's, that they've said, well, it could be cystic fibrosis,
Yeah.
also, or as well as.
Yeah.
But also another interesting point that you made, which I haven't heard before, but is the constant changing of milk.
Yes.
And thinking, right, well, it could be, because most times people just kind of go, right, well, they're not taking milk. Oh, maybe we'll try again later, or whatever it might be. But
Yeah.
actually changing milk, what was the kind of, what was the thought behind all of that?
I think Ollie was my second, and I just think, obviously, I know there's different milks, there's different formulas and stuff, and I was thinking maybe the one that he's drinking just isn't agreeing with him, or he doesn't like the taste. So I was like, we'll change it up a bit. So then we bought another formula, and it still was the exact same. He wasn't taking it, and I was like, right, there's only so much milk that you can buy. And trial and error. And if he doesn't take it, I'm like, I don't know what else this child is supposed to have. So then we changed bottles so that the teats were different, the flow was different, thinking maybe that's something. So everything I was trying at home, I was thinking that that was genuinely just it, and there wasn't anything significantly wrong with him
Yeah. I mean,
up
obviously,
to that
we
point.
now know what the issue was, but at the time, that sounds perfectly logical. And I just haven't heard that before. But actually, it
Yeah.
sounds, you know, maybe the taste is different. Maybe the way it gets into the body is slightly different.
Yeah,
Sounds
it was the
perfectly logical to me.
first thing that I thought of. I wasn't thinking, oh my goodness, he's got something wrong with him. Like, are there something happening on the inside? I was just like, maybe it is the milk. So let's try it. Turned out it wasn't. It was nothing to do with the milk.
But
The
then,
milk was fine.
yeah. But then, if you'd guessed Hirschsprung's disease at that stage, then yeah, I don't think that was the first thing that was running through your head at that
Oh,
point.
definitely not. Absolutely.
But yeah, so it sounds perfectly a logical step to me.
Yeah.
But then, so you said Ollie's diagnosed with Hirschsprung's day 8. From that point on, because sometimes, again, depending on where you are, sometimes nurses and doctors will say, well, this is the diagnosis, but don't Google it, or don't whatever. Were you discouraged from Googling, or was it just find out as much as you can?
So I kind of admitted that I am a serial Googler when it got the diagnosis. And I was told, try and stay away from it, because sometimes Google gives you obviously all the horror stories and everything, and try and stay away from it. So I got given this booklet. I've actually still kept it. That's what I was given. And it just basically told you what Hirschsprung's was, told you the symptoms, what can happen, how it's diagnosed, and like all the surgeries and everything else that comes along with it. And they gave me that with so much detail for the purpose so that I don't Google it.
Wow. That
their thinking was helpful. Everything that's in this booklet would take me away from Google.
Yeah, that's so helpful. Again, something I haven't seen or very rarely see.
Yeah.
Is hospitals kind of having some sort of resource leaflet,
yeah,
you know, paper or whatever. That's excellent.
Yeah. There's quite a few pages in it, and it's basically, it tells you obviously what Hirschsprung's is, all the surgeries that you can have, the treatments, if there's how long term it will be, the initial treatments and things, which did help, because Hirschsprung's disease obviously is ridiculously rare. So not everybody's heard of it or even knows what it is. So we were completely in the dark with the whole diagnosis. I'd never heard of it before, didn't know anybody else that had it. That it definitely did help. It was an eye-opener and scary at the same time, but it definitely was an eye-opener.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so good that they gave you some more info, but you're absolutely right that it is incredibly rare.
Yeah.
But obviously there's always, there's several different types as well. There's at least six, and then there's a toxicolonic plus, which could be a matter of different things.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it is incredibly rare. And there's no reason why you would have heard of it. I mean,
no.
There's so many people, myself included, who have no history of Hirschsprung's at all, even though we're told, obviously, it comes through genes and all of that stuff. But that's also not to say that it will be passed through the family, because I've known plenty of people, I've interviewed plenty of people who have Hirschsprung's, go on to have children who don't have Hirschsprung's. So it can just be, you know, one of those things.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Just a little mishap.
Yeah. There's still, you know, there's no rhyme or reason. It's not anything that anyone's done in pregnancy or anything. It's just that there's no...
That's one of the first things. As soon as you get told that your child's got something wrong with them, essentially, your first thought is, oh my God, what have I done? Have I missed something? Have I done something wrong? Like, could I have prevented it? That was one of my first questions as well. And it was like, it's not anything to do with pregnancy, the mum, anything. It can run in the genes.
Yeah, I guess that can be possibly reassuring in a way, but it's, yeah, that again, that's totally logical. We go, oh, did I eat something? Did I not do something that I was supposed to do, or whatever it might be? The natural thing is sort of to look at yourself and go, what have I done? But
yeah,
didn't, like, it is honestly just a roll of the dice. It is just Ollie is one of those 1 in 5,000 like myself, you know, yeah. No family history or anything.
One of the lucky ones that was chosen.
Lucky is a term, yeah.
Maybe not the right one.
It's definitely a term. But yeah, it is. And for anyone listening who maybe has just had a child diagnosed with Hirschsprung's, it is one of those things. It's not your fault, you know. It's nothing you've done. It's all research will point to the fact that it is just a random game of chance, I guess.
Yeah, it is. It definitely is.
So with that being said, Ollie being now 8 days old,
yep,
just diagnosed with Hirschsprung's, thankfully you've been given quite a bit of info, on sort of what to look for, what to do. I'm guessing things like enterocolitis was mentioned in there.
Enterocolitis was mentioned, yeah. We hadn't came across it just yet. But once he had his diagnosis, we were then introduced to rectal washouts, where obviously you have your catheter and your saline and things, and you flush them out essentially that way. For anything that's blocked in his bowel, we can remove it, because obviously essentially he can't. That's the whole problem. So with that, we did the rectal flushouts. Doctors and surgeons did them first, and then we got shown how to do it so that we could get home. He's been diagnosed, it's long segment Hirschsprung's that he has. And the surgeon that he was given at the start was more than happy to do it. He knew what Hirschsprung's was and knew everything about it, until they investigated Ollie a little bit further and realised he was a little bit more advanced than an average child with Hirschsprung's. So we had to change surgeons to a surgeon that had just come back from Australia. And essentially he was now our surgeon for the whole of Ollie's life up until now. But basically everything at the top half of Ollie, everything had to get spun round because he had long segment Hirschsprung. So everything essentially inside him all got removed and turned upside down essentially when he had his first operation.
And
it will make more sense with more up-to-date information.
Would that be the pull-through then?
Yes.
Wow.
So when he was diagnosed 8 days old, we were then told then that essentially he would need bowel pull-through surgery. It was set for, he would have been 2 months old when that was put in place to do. And then when Ollie went into the hospital to get it done, he went into hospital maybe the week before with suspected enterocolitis.
Oh no, the dreaded UC. So
yes, that was our first kind of a insight into what enterocolitis was. And it's not pretty.
It really isn't, no.
It's not. And it's not your average sickness and diarrhoea bug, because even now, like, I'll explain to Ollie things and how he can be fine just now, and within half an hour it could change, because enterocolitis hits so fast and it's probably one of the most dangerous infections that you can have if you don't catch it very quickly.
It is most definitely, yeah, it is definitely, but like you say, it is very fast acting, and it can be very sudden. And it's that awareness, and it doesn't have huge amount of symptoms from what I'm aware. But there are certain signs that you can see, and you think, actually, something's not quite right here.
Uh-huh. And it's a little bit annoying as well, because even still now, when you get the blood tests and the stool samples and things like that, it never ever comes back completely positive for enterocolitis. They just automatically treat it as enterocolitis because it has got the symptoms. It could be another bug, but they'll always go and treat it as enterocolitis just to keep it on the safe side of things.
Yeah, I think it's always best to err on the side of caution at that point, especially with Hirschsprung's, and especially with what enterocolitis can do if obviously not treated. But excellent that you kind of caught it quickly, I guess.
It's a very isolating infection, because when Ollie gets taken into the hospital with enterocolitis, because it is obviously an infection, it gets put into source. He's not allowed any visitors, he's not allowed out the room, he's not allowed anything. But he's maybe had in his life, he's maybe had about 5 or 6 episodes where it's been suspected enterocolitis that he's been in hospital with. He's had about 5 or 6, but quite a lot of them were before he had his pull through, and after he's had his reversal.
Right. See, yeah, I mean that's still quite a lot. 5 or 6.
It is quite a lot. He's now 11, and he's not had it for, I don't know, maybe about 4 years, maybe. He's not had a symptom of enterocolitis or anything. But when he was about 4 months old, he then got the green light to get his pull through surgery.
Good. But I mean, that's good to know that hasn't had anything for the last four years or so. But has there been anything within that time that you've done differently to try and sort of
the only thing differently he has is there's been different medications that he's tried to try and thicken poo. There's been the probiotic yogurts, he's had Botox injections, but when he had his bowel pull through, they told us that it would be pretty straightforward. And we would only be away for a few hours. In the worst case scenario, he would come back with a stoma. But they would really, really try and not make that be the case. So on the day of Ollie's surgery, he went down to theatre. Everything was fine. After the kind of a 4-hour mark, alarm bell started ringing, because I was like, why is he not back yet? Then the 6-hour mark went past. I was very, very slowly starting to freak out. And we were in a 4-bed bay in the hospital. And in our hospital, they've got like hospital clowns and things. So there was another baby on this 4-bed bay. I'll always remember it. And they came in and they were blowing bubbles. And they had their tambourines and they were singing and dancing. And I was sitting next to an empty bed, slowly losing the will to live. And I was like, please just leave. With all due respect, please just go just now. So then about 8.5 hours had gone. And a surgeon walked towards me and I was like, oh no. And basically, they had said that he was more advanced. There was a lot more to remove. And so he's had to come back with a stoma bag at the same time. So we were trying to prepare for the stoma bag, but at the same time they did say if it wasn't needed, if they could get away with not, then that would be fine. So that as much as he's just went for life-saving changing surgery, he's now then came back with something else that we didn't think he was going to have. And if you haven't ever saw a stoma before, it's quite scary looking.
Yeah.
It's bizarre. It's not the nicest. It freaked me out a little bit. But it seemed to work, and it seemed he had his stoma bag for maybe about 6 months, and what a difference that made. With there was no infections, there was no, he didn't have any symptoms of ventriculitis, and from that point I was thinking maybe a stoma bag is actually the right thing for him, because up until the point of him being born to getting the stoma bag, it was in the hospital every month, maybe twice every month for a week at a time with enterocolitis. It was a lot on him. But Ollie being Ollie, it's a standing joke now that if it wasn't for bad luck, we wouldn't have any. He caught a wound infection around his stomach, and on Mother's Day, which was maybe 2 or 3 days later, his stoma prolapsed. And that was something else.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real. But that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
The station that makes you feel good.
With the prolapse, I've heard this from several people before, but did they give you the sugar trick?
Yes.
Did it work?
It did. It took a while to go back in, so if nobody has saw a stoma prolapse before, the only way that I could describe it, it's like an octopus tentacle. Like, that's the only way that I can describe it to anybody so that they realise, like, what it looks like. So it came out, so we had to cover him and hold it in, and the surgeons came, and eventually it went back in, which was fine. It was perfect. So then we were told that if it happens again, he might need to go back to theatre because they might need to kind of put it back in and stitch it kind of on the sides. So we had left and went home that night. We had the option to stay in Ronald McDonald House, but we stay literally 15 minutes from the hospital. So we were like, we're close enough to get there. And because it was in intensive care, you're not allowed to stay in the hospital anyway. So we had gone home, and the hospital had phoned through the night and it had prolapsed again. So we were like, okay. So we took ourselves to the hospital. They managed to put it back in again and it stayed back in, but it was on very close watch for needing to go back to theatre again. But it never came back again. Everything was fine. And then he then had his reversal, which went swimmingly. Nothing really happened in the run-up to that. He got his reversal. Everything was fine. The only problem he had when they reversed it, he then had another wound infection. But I think because his whole system, he doesn't have an immune system in there or anything that he gets attacks his bowel. So I think anytime he gets anything done, any surgeries or anything, he gets some form of infection. But I think it's just a really run down area, which you've got to take the good with the bad. And like, I'll take a wound infection over enterocolitis rather than, do you know what I mean? I would rather have that. So the only thing that he had was he had a wound infection, and then the vomiting and the diarrhea started a couple of days later. So I was like, right, okay. Wasn't enterocolitis. He had norovirus that he's caught while being in the hospital. So Ollie's maybe had, he's maybe had norovirus 3 times. And every time it puts him into the hospital, because obviously, as you know, everything just goes through your bubble. It goes through your bubble, and because Ollie only has a fifth of his bowel left, and because of that, it doesn't really hold absorption of water or anything. So he dehydrates really quickly. So obviously, sickness and diarrhea, you do dehydrate anyway. But with a child with Hirschsprung's and only a fifth of his bowel left, it's on another level. So it always puts him into the hospital, put on fluids to bring his hydration and things back up, and then start again. So he's been, every time he's been in, he's been brought home with antibiotics. So he's either had metronidazole or comoxiclav, are always the two that he gets given. But again, to me, when all this kind of started in the norovirus, I know that obviously isn't a bowel-related necessarily infection, but the infections and the enterocolitis and things seemed to come back when he had his stoma reversal. So from then, I had in my head, and I had talks with these surgeons, and I was like, I think a stoma bag is the way forward for Ollie. It seemed to be when he had that stoma bag, and that whole time before he got his reversal, he was never in the hospital. He never had an infection. He was doing well in himself. Everything seemed to have changed. And then when he got the reversal, it was as if we went back the way. As if it gave you that little glimpse of hope that that's what life could be like. But then it took away and go, no, it's, that's not for you. Which yeah, obviously wasn't the greatest. And I get sometimes with Hirschsprung's and the treatments and things, it's trial and error, which is annoying in itself, because you obviously want, what I thought was best for Ollie was a stoma bag, but it's obviously not always the answer. Surgeries aren't always the answer, because after they've had surgery so many times, they kind of don't want to put them through that again, or put them through the trauma or anything. So I get that, and I get there's always another option, a less invasive option or anything like that. So once he'd had his stoma reversal, we then had to do rectal washouts with the anal dilations with the rod. It was a 10 millimetre metal rod to open up his bum and then do the washouts like we did when he was a brand new baby. And we did them, but we had to do it twice a day, every day, which is quite a lot. And it's a lot of pressure, I think. Obviously, as a parent, you do it. It's your child, you do it. If it's going to help them, you do it. But mentally, it's a lot. It's a lot to try and master, get to terms with it, and realise that you then have to do this on your child, but you're doing it on your child to give them the best possible outcome and the best possible life. But I think the whole process with Hirschsprung's is a very, very mentally challenging one, like ridiculously mentally challenging.
Yeah, and I think that that it is on everyone, parents and people with Hirschsprungs. And I think that's something that I have talked to parents about a little bit, but probably not as often as I would like. That there's a lot of invasive procedures when it comes to Hirschsprungs. And I think that has a huge toll mentally, especially if you are the person who is performing the procedures as well.
Yeah.
You know, and I think this is always going to be the thing of, you know, am I doing this 100% correctly? Am I, you know, all of that stuff. And I think same with people with Hirschsprungs, having a lot of invasive procedures, especially within the stomach area as well, is very mentally draining. And especially with the lot of research that I've read in terms of the gut health and mental health being hugely linked, I think it's not a surprise that Hirschsprungs is quite a mentally draining, or can be quite a mentally draining condition.
Yeah. No, definitely. I do think, and I think sometimes as well, I always think to myself, God, would I like somebody to be doing that to me all the time? Do you know? And obviously, he was a lot younger then, but it seems to be harder the older he got. All his thing was, he loved going to the hospital. As soon as he took not well, loved it. The only child I know loved going to the hospital, loved seeing everybody in the hospital. I was on first name terms with all the doctors and nurses. We would go up every single morning. We would be there from like 7 o'clock in the morning for the nurse changeover to see what happens through the night. And we would be there the whole night until it got to a point where it was on a ward where we could stay. And we would go up, and Ollie would be sitting in his pram out at the nurse's station, just making pals, making friends with everybody. And that was his thing, as if, in a very strange and roundabout way, as if that was his safe space, being there, because he knew all the nurses, he knew who was looking after him. And he got to a stage where, in the hospital, if he had a cannula or anything in, which they struggled massively with him eventually, if he had them in his feet, they would keep his socks on for him to go to bed. And it seems to be that even now he's 11, he won't go to bed unless he's got his socks on. It's like little things like that. And I'm like, they obviously go in and they stay in there because that's his normal.
Yeah.
That's his normal, and he thinks it's not any different. But the older he got to take him to hospital, he would know he wasn't well. But then it would be the, do I need to get a drag? Do I need to get my bloods done? Do they need to touch my bum? Do they need to put anything? And it was all the kind of questions, and all the questions sometimes I didn't have the answer to. But then that made me a bad person because I couldn't tell him. Because me then saying, I don't know, didn't help him in his head come to terms with what was going to happen when he got in there at the same time.
That doesn't make you a bad person. That doesn't make you a bad person at all. I know.
Right. The whole time I always somehow had an answer for him. And then when he got older and he could ask questions, and I was like, I'm not really the person that to give you the answer to that question. But even now, like when he's in hospital, he then, the older he's got, it's as if he becomes a little bit more reserved and shy and doesn't want to ask. If a surgeon's speaking to him, he won't ask. He'll look at me as if, you ask. Or he'll say it once they've walked away. And I'm like, you are a bigger person now. You need to be the person to ask the questions, because I don't know. I don't know what it feels like inside. I don't know. Like, it needs to come from him. He's the best person to tell anybody.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a tricky one, isn't it? It's a really tricky one, because yes, it absolutely, you know, he's the one who knows how he's feeling. Yeah. It'd be the best place to ask those questions. But also, I guess, being the age he is now, it can sometimes be a bit tricky to talk about certain things with Hirschsprungs, So it's that really tricky balancing act, I guess.
I think with obviously certain areas of Hirschsprungs, it's a little bit private. It can be embarrassing. And I get that. I do get that. And I'm like, you need to, obviously, the older he's got and he's had, he's had 4 rounds of the Botox injections, which are there essentially to retrain the brain to the bowel on how to work and how to let go. Because all these things, the older he was getting, not even the older he was getting, he seemed to have more accidents at night time through the night. But obviously, essentially, everything's more relaxed at night time. But on the same hand, Ollie wasn't letting fully go during the day. So there was too much at night time. So the Botox injections seemed to be the next option for him that weren't necessarily invasive surgery related. Yeah, you got taken to theatre and put to sleep, but you were only there for about 40 minutes. And it was pretty straightforward and everything was fine. So he had them 4 times he's had them now. The first 3 times didn't see any change. But they do say it can work, it might not work, but you need to try it. So the first 3 times there was no significant change. Everything kind of stayed the same. On the 4th, everything started to change after the first week. For maybe about 4 weeks. And then it went right back to normal again. Where he was managing, he could tell you that he needed to go to the toilet. Whereas, obviously, with a child with Hirschsprungs, depending on the form that you have, you don't know that you've went to the toilet. Which was Ollie's thing that he struggled with massively. And we were trying to get it under control for going to school. So when he started school, I had several meetings with the school to obviously explain the situation and that if Ollie needs to go to the toilet, he needs to go there and then. He can't wait 3 minutes until the teacher's done talking to somebody, because in that 3 minutes, everything can change. And I had a bit of trouble with the school. I had taken everything in from the care package and things that they had from nursery, all hospital letters and everything, and took it to the school. And essentially the head teacher at the school just said that I hadn't toilet trained him and that I was lazy, and I had taught him how to go to the toilet for a pee but hadn't taught him how to go to the toilet to go for a poo. And that's what the problem was. So when he was at school, I was fighting a losing battle. Didn't think that it would ever be a thing. I didn't think I would then be questioned or made to feel that size with my child's disability. But I was lazy and hadn't toilet trained him.
Horrific. I mean, I guess the question would be, did they even know what Hirschsprungs was?
So that was me. I took my little booklet to for all in, and I asked her very politely if she could have a read of it and then come back to me if she still felt the same. So with that being said, and obviously them not really thinking that there was anything wrong with Ollie, there was several, very, very several occasions Ollie would come home and he'd had an accident. A significant accident. He was soiled. I picked him up one day from school and he had soiled, and I could smell it when I got him. So I was like, how could nobody else? Surely somebody else. And then my thinking was, he was only in primary 1, primary 2 maybe. And I was like, kids can be horrible. And with Hirschsprungs especially, it's always been my fear on how horrible kids can be. And essentially, it is probably the first pick to be bullied if it's not under wraps and you don't take care of it and have everything in place. So I had got Ollie from school one day and he was soiled. His bum was red raw, and it essentially, it turned into a bacterial infection. that he had because he had sat, and it was every single day it was happening, and he's been sitting for 6 hours and couldn't get it under control. So I had to fight until he was maybe in primary three, primary four. And then eventually he was given a one-to-one teacher for going to the toilets. And she did her research on Hirschsprungs and stuff. And I know not everybody knows about Hirschsprungs. There's not going to be a teacher support out there that knows essentially what it is. But ideally, I wasn't asking her to do anything related to Hirschsprungs. It was just a case of, please make sure he goes to the toilet. If he's soiled, there's a bag of clothes to change him. He's got wipes, he's got his creams, he's got everything there to try and prevent that from happening again. That happened for maybe 6 months. And then that teacher left and they never told me.
Yeah, but thank you so, so much for coming on. This has been an episode. And I wish, obviously, Ollie, yourself, and the rest of the family, all the very best for the future.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Hirschsprungs Hour on UK Health Radio. You can find me on Facebook under Tom's Hirschsprungs Podcast or Instagram on Tom's_Hirschsprungs_podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show and we'll bring you another episode soon.